I want to welcome to the show Senator Steve Harding, who covers a lot of the Brookfield area, because I wanted to talk a little bit more about what we can do about the bear populations in our state. And we've seen a lot of bear encounters, specifically in Avon, but certainly in parts all across Connecticut. And I thought Senator Harding could really weigh in on the conversation, give us some perspective, and what possibilities are now on the table to handle the population a little bit better. Hey there, Senator Harding. Thank you for your time. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. It's wonderful to have me on. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this very important issue, particularly to my area of the state.
Yeah. Tell us, if you don't mind, about Brookfield. Yeah. Have you guys had a lot of encounters as well?
Yeah. So Brookfield certainly has had have seen a significant spike in bear sightings and kind of human-bear interactions, most of which, knock on wood, and at least in Brookfield, none of which have gotten very dangerous that I'm aware of. But as you go further and further north into my district, north of Brookfield into Milford and further into Litchfield County, particularly up in Salisbury and Sharon, Morris in particular, a 10-year-old boy was attacked by a bear this past October. Mm-hmm. And without some fortunate circumstances, thank God, being in place at that particular time, it could have been very tragic what occurred. Thankfully, the bear got scared away and ran off, but certainly very, very scary for the family and for that young man. Up in Salisbury the past, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, a bear had broken into a home 3 separate times. And even on one occasion, the last time the bear had broken in, a deep had actually come up and set up some traps, and the bear figured out a way around the traps and still got into the house. It is becoming an increasingly more dangerous issue, particularly in the northwest corner of the state. Obviously, Melissa, as you mentioned, there was an attack in Avon where, fortunately, I believe the woman that was attacked, knock on wood, turned out to be okay, at least physically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is becoming increasingly more and more dangerous. And what I fear is it could end up being tragic if we don't do something about this. So there is a proposal that is before the legislature. I'm fortunate enough to be the Senate ranking member on the Environment Committee, in which this particular bill came out of that committee. It's a multifaceted approach to helping to address the bear management in our state. There are more things I would have liked to have seen in the bill, particularly, you know, pursuant to DEEP's recommendations and the experts at DEEP. Maybe a limited, very, very limited regulated hunting season and maybe 6 limited areas of the state where there is an increasingly dangerous and growing population. That did not have the votes, that's my understanding, to move forward. But there are some still very good aspects of the current bear management bill that's before us that I think would go a long way in at least taking the steps we need to take to start addressing this issue.
So, Senator Harding, again, a ranking senator on the Environment Committee here in Connecticut, can you tell us some of the aspects of this bill that's being debated right now?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first aspect of the bill was a proposal by my predecessor, Senator Minor, who retired this past year. And he put forward a proposal that unfortunately didn't have enough votes in previous years that would allow property owners address a bear, execute a bear, if they can demonstrate to DEEP that the bear is essentially eating all its crops, destroying its crops, and also, you know, killing its livestock. If you can demonstrate that to DEEP, then you can address the bear issue yourself. Extremely limited, certainly not at all a hunting season, just isolated to that one particular property, isolated to that particular bear. And again, there's a very bureaucratic process that's involved with that for DEEP to even approve you doing that. But that's one thing that I heard from a lot of particularly farmers, and particularly in the northwest corner of our state, who, you know, not only ever having their property and crops destroyed unfortunately, on a rather routine basis by the bears, but are also seeing their livestock killed.
So really quick, though, Senator Harding, can I pause you there for a really quick second? Because I totally understand where the farmers are coming from. I mean, we have over 5,000 farms here in Connecticut, which is very significant. I don't know if people realize how important our agricultural sector is, but it's extremely important, not just here, but also across the nation, people using products from Connecticut farms. But does that then open a door to any wildlife? Like, would that then open the door to, okay, well, like, why stop at bears? Why not include feral cats and fox and you know, deer? I mean, anything. Because, like, how do you prove that, other than, like, video proof, I guess, that bears are really the only entity ruining your livestock or your crops?
Yep. Well, I think bears, particularly in our area of the state, it goes beyond just crops, right? And that's why I made sure to mention livestock. I mean, the deer is not killing any livestock, right? Mm-hmm. We all know that. And we also have a regulated hunting season for most of these other predators that destroy property for farmers. So The deer, as we know, has a very, you know, robust hunting season in the state of Connecticut. We already have a deer management plan, essentially, through a hunting season and other measures that we have in the state.
Do we have it for coyotes, though? Like, I think about coyotes as well.
Coyotes, there's currently a process already.
There is.
Similar to the process that we're trying to enact with bears.
Okay.
So this would just, and frankly, to be honest, when we first started trying to address this particular bill, it was actually unclear, by the way, the language was written, whether bears fell into this. I think it's pretty understood and explicit that coyotes fall under this particular statute. But now with this legislation, bears would be explicitly within this statute. So I look at it as a measure. It's not singling out bears. I think
it's sort of odd that they're not already. Like, I would kind of feel suspect as to why would we have things in place for animals that absolutely could be aggressive or could be a threat to livestock or children or people or property, but we wouldn't have that in place for bears. That is interesting.
Yeah. Right, and that's the reason I think the language was somewhat open-ended as to why there was kind of a debate whether or not the language already provided an avenue for property owners to do what we're trying to do in this particular bill. That's number one. I think secondarily, as you know, Melissa, well, the bear population was really not an issue here if you date back 30, 40 years ago. I mean,
absolutely.
I grew up in this state.
Same.
I grew up in the northwest corner, and I really – bears was never anything I ever thought about, to
be honest. I agree. I agree with you.
And now it's – yeah, and so I think that due to this, I think we're kind of forced to have another reevaluation of where we stand in terms of bears. And I think that I'm taking the side that we need to start, as you mentioned, including bears in the current policies that we have already in place with other predators to protect our livestock, to protect our property in some circumstances, and overall just to manage the population for public safety purposes. And you know, if you speak with some conservationists, for conservation purposes as well, it's not always good to have an overpopulation of one particular species, even within that own species. You know, there's a limited amount of food and resources to go around.
We've talked a lot about this on the show. We talk about it really on a lot of the shows here on WICC in general, the bear population and what can be done about it. There's a lot of bear versus people, bear versus property, bear versus livestock happening, these situations all across our state. And particularly there are parts of the state that are seeing it more than others. And the question is, what can be done about it to better handle the situation? We know that bear hunts are basically at least out of the question for now, but there is a current piece of legislation that could help in many ways. And we are talking this morning to Senator Steve Harding, and he is actually a ranking senator on the Environment Committee. Senator Harding, what are the chances that we see this piece of legislation get approval and pass before the session wraps up in June?
I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that, you know, I give credit to my, you know, fellow senators and representatives on both sides of the aisle here from really all across the state. That realize, based upon, you know, again, these dangerous human people and bear interactions, that we're seeing on the news, and they understand the urgency of this. They understand, most importantly, the significant public safety aspect of this. And I'm hearing it again from both Democrats and Republicans. And when you see that on both sides of the aisle, it usually means that there's a significant chance that the bill is going to go through. So the Senate bill, so it's going to come before us first. It's had some trips back and forth from the Capitol back to the LOB. When I mean the LOB, I mean the committees that it's been before. So it came out of the Environment Committee. We got sent to the Senate, went back to the Judiciary Committee for their review. It came out of Judiciary with a rather significant plurality, came back to the Senate, and now it's sitting on the Senate calendar waiting for a vote. So my hope is we're in, I think, at least 4 days next week, maybe even five. One of those days, hopefully earlier next week, we can get a vote on it. And then that still gives it a week or and change. In fact, it gives it about 3 weeks for it to finally get a vote in the House. I am cautiously optimistic. I mean, obviously, with every bill, you're going to have some individuals that might have some objections. As I mentioned at the beginning of this call, there's aspects of the bill that I believe should be included. There's aspects of the bill that I have some reservations about. But at the end of the day, I think it is a comprehensive policy that's well thought out, that's reasonable, that excludes some of the more objectionable provisions on either side of the debate. And I think that usually produces good policy, and it also produces results in terms of getting a plurality of the vote in both chambers and getting the bill called. So I would say there's a better than 50% chance that this is going to pass this year, and I think it will be a good thing for the people of the state of Connecticut.
Well, and so it's encouraging, certainly, that there's bipartisan support. The only thing, Senator Harding, is that we know there are thousands and thousands of bills that are presented each legislative session. This one more mm-hmm. than it seems like others, and I think partially that could be because we're back in person. But with that being said, I mean, I've seen some pieces of legislation that I thought, wait, really? There's bipartisan support, and it got shot down, or it just didn't make it out of committee. Yeah, I think that's what it is, I guess that's a better question, is what are the chances it gets out of committee versus, you know, it sounds like the chances of it passing, that seems like that's very, that looks pretty good. But as far as it actually being right. called up for a vote, you feel like it's mm-hmm. more than 50% of you feels like
yes.
confident that'll happen?
Yeah, that's really the question, Melissa, and you hit the nail on the head with what the real question is here. Because, again, I think if you put that bill up on the board of both the Senate and the House for a vote, I am very confident, almost certain, that it would pass. It would get a majority of – exactly.
Mm.
So the real question is it going to get called in both the Senate and called in the House? And,
right.
Frankly, my only reservation right now is really the House. I'm almost 100% certain that bill will be called in the Senate. I'm almost certain it will be next week. You know, the question I have is that once it goes down from the Senate to the House, is it going to get called in the House? That's kind of the usually the issue, because, again, as you know, the House has 151 members. And if one or two members have a significant issue with the bill, that could cause significant problems for the bill. There's only 36 of us up in the Senate. It makes things a little easier sometimes getting it out. So despite all that, I'm very certain, I don't want to say very certain, but I'm fairly certain that we can get a vote on this in both chambers and thus get this passed for the people of the state.
If it does pass, Senator Harding, when would it go into effect?
I think the legislation would go into effect in October. It would be in October 1. I'll confirm that, but I believe it's October 1 of 2023. That it would allow DEEP to promulgate any regulations that were necessary and begin that process. So it would be a rather quick turnaround, and I think the public safety urgency, as we talked about, is probably the reasoning as to why, you know, you'd see the law go into effect so quick.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, Senator Harding, I really appreciate you doing a deep dive on this with us and answering all our questions. Certainly would love
Absolutely.
An update. I would love to see it come out of committee and see what happens and see it go to the House
yep.
and the Senate for a vote. So keep us posted.
Will do, Melissa. Hope to be on soon. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, absolutely. You are welcome back anytime. Again, Senator Steve Harding, who is a Republican with the Brookfield area and surrounding area. He is also the ranking senator on the Environment Committee, talking about how to handle the bear populations in Connecticut here on WICC. We'll see what happens with the current legislation being debated up in Hartford. And hopefully we see some movement by the time the legislative session wraps up in June. Every parent wants to get it right, and we're just not going to. But man, it takes a village to raise a kid. It's always been that way. Certainly in 2023, nothing has really changed. It's still a challenge, and we want to make sure we are raising happy, confident, high-functioning children in today's society, and we can use all the help we can get. So we came across this program that's apparently happening in Ridgefield, and I wanted to know all about it. So we have with us here Doug Burrill, who's telling us about parent circles in Ridgefield. Doug, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here, and thanks for getting up early for the show. Tell me what the parent circle is. How long have you been offering this in Ridgefield?
Well, this is actually something that started, unfortunately, based on some untimely teen deaths back in 2005. One was a drunken driving accident where teens were killed, another a drug overdose. And it started as a reaction to that, where our first selectman, Rudy Marconi, and our then superintendent of schools got together and decided we have to do something about what's become an increasingly problematic thing. Over time, while it started initially to focus on drugs and alcohol and educating parents on the risks that they needed to be aware of, a lot of it was around educating them on what's out there in terms of drugs and alcohol, what they lock up your medicine cabinet and your liquor cabinet and things like that. It's evolved over time as the needs of parents have evolved to be much more a focus on healthy development and what can we do as parents to promote healthy development to prevent not only drug and alcohol abuse, but other issues that, you know, like the anxiety crisis that we're dealing with today.
Sure.
And depression among kids, the technology revolution and how that's impacted children and various other things.
So explain to me, Doug, like take me inside one of these meetings. First of all, where do they happen? How many people attend them typically? What ages are we talking about? Give me some logistics.
Right. That's evolved a lot, too. They initially were large group PowerPoint presentations alerting parents to what they needed to know. They've evolved over time to be now small groups, 12 is the maximum that I'll have in a group typically, and they're more discussion-oriented. We find that parents have become more savvy over time. They're much more aware of the risks out there. What they really want to do is share information and ideas and have some input from a mental health professional on the things, the latest research, what they need to know. So we typically, it's a mix of sharing information and discussion among the groups. The parents find that they really enjoy hearing what their peers are dealing with, that I'm not alone in this foxhole situation. And so that part, a smaller kind of group format has really proven to, you know, be very valuable to them in the feedback that I get. We do three tiers. We initially started out, it was all about adolescents, and the focus was there, fifth grade parents and eighth grade parents, the transition to adolescents, and then the transition to high school. So entering middle school, entering high school. What we found, though, was that the parents were saying, gee, I wish I had this information earlier. You know, I wish I really, I've now developed some bad habits with my kids. We get into shouting matches, you know, where, you know, and escalatory kinds of things that are, you know, have really ruptured our relationship. So my kids don't want to talk to me anymore. So we now have a kindergarten circle program where we deal with parents, again, the transition to school. So each of these are based on transitions, transition to school, transition to middle school, transition to high school. And they typically coincide with developmental milestones. So the focus of each is different. And I can tell you a little bit about what that is, if you'd like.
Yeah, so we're talking today to Doug Burrill. And actually, Doug, I didn't get to introduce what your title is with the Parent Circle. What exactly is it that you do? Like, are you the facilitator? Are you the creator? What is your title?
Well, I'm a little bit of all of those things. I'm a marriage and family therapist by training. I have a private practice, and I also work with our Youth Service Bureau to do youth counseling. And I was asked by Rudy, our first electman, to lead this program back then, and I've been doing it ever since. I facilitate the programs. I occasionally will have another mental health professional helping me if I can't handle it all. But, yeah, it's pretty much evolved to be me.
I mean, I was going to ask you, Doug, like, what, you know, yes, I would like to hear more about the specifics of the program as you were going to dive into. But I also wanted to know if you see a big change. Do you ever see people leave the group feeling like they came in discouraged, but they leave encouraged? Like, do you see that transition? Do you see that transformation?
Well, that's what we hope for.
Right.
You know, and we have such a variety of parents that come in, you know, parents that are overwhelmed with, you know, kids with learning disabilities, ADHD, and things that make their lives more challenging. And increasingly what we're seeing, of course, is dual career parents. So you have multiple children, both parents are working, and I don't think they sometimes knew what they signed up for. Mm-hmm. And so in other cases, we have stay-at-home parents who are 100% focused on parenting, and maybe one of the challenges there is over-parenting. And, you know, the move from helicopter to enmeshed parenting where the kids don't have a chance to breathe or to make mistakes, and that's another issue. But there's a big variety, and I think different parents get different things out of it. But what we hope will happen is after we work with them, initially, these parent groups stay active without me, and that's my hope. And we have one that's been going on for 6 years now. It started with kindergarten parents, and they're still going, and their kids are now well into middle school.
That's amazing.
And they just really find value in getting together once a month and talking about the issues they're dealing with. And occasionally we'll bring in somebody from the outside to support them.
It takes a village to raise a child. And this is a nice chunk of village people who like to get together and do what's called a parent circle. We're talking to Doug Burrill, who has a lot of different hats, but sort of took on this project of a parent circle in Ridgefield after, it sounds like that Rudy Marconi had asked you to kind of continue this and take this on after some really unfortunate events involving young people happened in Ridgefield. And I'm wondering, Doug, has anyone ever reached out to you, other municipalities, saying, hey, we love this model, we love this concept, what do you do? How can we incorporate it in our towns or cities? Has that ever happened?
Not directly, but I'm happy to try to help out if I can. You know, I know there are some other communities doing programs for parents. I haven't heard of anything exactly like this one. So have at me.
I mean, I'm curious, does it cost parents anything to be part of this group?
No. In fact, what's terrific is we get great sponsorship from our first selectmen. They formed an organization called ARCASA, Ridgefield Community Coalition Against Substance Abuse, which back in 2005. And they're the primary sponsors. They allocate some money each year to support this. Parents don't pay anything. It is a free program. The Ridgefield Library provides the space when the town doesn't have enough space in their offices. So we've had a lot of support. The PTAs are very active. The superintendent has given me access to all our principals who are the vehicle by which we make parents aware of this program at various grade levels. So tremendous community support. And I'm really indebted to Rudy and to our superintendent for just keeping this going and providing the support I need.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I would imagine that a lot of parents not only appreciate getting, you know, tips and hearing feedback, but also just feeling like they're not alone. I mean, you could probably speak to that very well, knowing that you work with marriages and families. A lot of times, part of the biggest issue we see with problems in the home is that we feel like no one could ever understand what I'm going through. I'm the failing parent. You know what I mean? So just having that community of, nope, I'm feeling that too, or nope, we're having that same issue with little Johnny or whatever. Like, I would think this is such a positive place to be, not just to get maybe some feedback and some tools or tricks to bettering a situation, but also to just feel like I'm not alone in this.
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the more important things, I think, not only in this program, but in actually working with individual families, is normalizing what some parents believe could be, you know, something really unusual. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the behavior of adolescence, of course, and I don't know, Melissa, if you're a parent.
I am. I have a almost five-year-old.
All right. Well, you'll find out when they reach adolescence that all bets are off, right?
Yeah,
and,
I've heard that.
You know, some of them act out. Some of them internalize their struggles and feel depressed and down. And as a parent, if you don't understand that a certain amount of this is normal and then they will get through it, you can overreact. You can make things more difficult for them. And it's sometimes really, you're right on target, really reassuring for them to hear, oh, yeah, you have that too. And that's a lot of what happens in these groups.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think, like you said, Doug, I think absolutely the adolescent years are so challenging. But it really, I mean, we've even seen with our own son, who's four, almost five, that we just don't have the answers and there are no books. I mean, there are a lot of self-help books and all
right.
that, but there's no, you know, exact answer of this is what it is. Here's the solution. And so with that, you know, everybody has their own interpretations, but it is nice when you can put the ego aside and go, hey, I'm struggling with this. Does anyone know what I can do? And how can I help with this situation? I think there's just so much positivity out of this model. And I have to say, I am surprised you haven't gotten direct contact from other municipalities. Like if I ran a town or city, I'd be like, Doug, give me all the wisdom, buddy. What do you want me to do to because I think like this is something I'd love to be part of a group like this. If I lived in Ridgefield, this just sounds like an amazing opportunity. You guys have so many listings here. Like I'm looking at the Ridgefield town website right now, and just this month and next, you also offer so many opportunities for people to have these conversations. I'm seeing Wednesday evenings, Thursday mornings, Monday nights, Friday mornings. Like, it's not just you missed it. Like, there are so many opportunities to come. It doesn't cost you any money. And I think all it does is support you, maybe give you some tools on how to handle the situation and make you feel a lot better as a parent, make you feel better equipped walking out than you did walking in. So I salute you, Doug. I love this group, the Parent Circle. If people want to find more information, how do they go about doing that?
Well, they're welcome to contact me directly. I'm more than happy to share what I've learned from this and what works for us. And they can contact me at DougBurrill@gmail.com.
All right. Simple enough. And Doug, again, I thank you for the work that you're doing. Keep it up. And I look forward to hopefully having you back on the show again soon.
Oh, thanks, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Doug Burrill again, and we are talking about the Parent Circle in Ridgefield here on WICC. As you know, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and a new study is showing just, I guess, how good Connecticut is when it comes to mental health care. Joining us back on the show is Dr. Andre Newfield of Hartford Healthcare. So glad to have you here, Dr. Newfield, Chair of Psychiatry at St. Vincent's Medical Center. How are you?
Not bad, Melissa. How are you? Thanks so much for having me during Mental Health Awareness Month.
Absolutely. It's pretty fitting to have you back on the show. We love having your advice and your outlook on mental health and a lot of topics that we've gone into before, some really dark topics and some lighter and everything in between. So I always appreciate that you give us the time on the show. Connecticut apparently has the 7th best mental health care in the U.S. I was a little taken aback by that, but okay. I mean, kudos. That's great.
Yeah, there are a variety of studies. I've seen it ranked as high as number 4, I think as low as number 12. I mean, all these studies basically take into consideration, you know, how many are the percentage of the state that has mental health issues, how many of them are insured or uninsured, and how many of them are having needs met, how many of them are, you know, just not receiving care. And so, you know, interestingly enough, Connecticut is in the top tier, which is really reassuring.
So where did that study come from? Do we have any background on that? I mean, that's, again, when you look at the entire country, the fact that Connecticut landed in the top 10 for best mental health care, especially in these last couple of years where there's been such a focus on it, I would think that is very reassuring for residents here in Connecticut.
Yeah, there are various, entities that perform these studies. I think the one that we're both talking about was done by an insurance company, but, you know, various different sources of data are showing that Connecticut is, you know, around the top 20%, you know, give or take, which is pretty good.
Yeah, no, certainly. And we know, Dr. Newfield, that you are one of the many specialists that is working in the mental health sector for a lot of patients here in Connecticut. Let's talk about the most common mental health issues you and your fellow colleagues are tackling in 2023. What would you say are some of the most common that you come across at the workplace?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of people with increasing amounts of substance abuse and increasing rates of depression and anxiety. I think, you know, as we've talked about numerous times, you know, those are probably the most common things we're seeing. Obviously, there's a wide variety. I don't want to give the illusion just because Connecticut is as highly rated as we've been discussing that there isn't more work to be done. You know, it'd be great to increase the percentage of people that are getting mental health care in our state, or the percentage that have insurance, the people that can find access to care. It's really, really challenging, especially for those kids out there that need treatment. I think people that have these problems and aren't in care are struggling to find their care despite, you know, the options. And so there's just more work to be done constantly. This is a really tough problem for us.
I'm actually really glad you said that, Dr. Newfield, and I hope earlier in the interview it didn't offend you when I said that was kind of surprising to me, not because of the quality of doctors. Like, I know your track record in how, you know, how you are as a professional in the workplace, but I guess it was more of the access to quality. So we may have the best of the best, but as far as, you know, health insurance covering, for example, mental health needs, that is such a murky area that we still haven't even really worked out enough for people to access the professionals who could really help them through these problems. That's why I was kind of shocked by that finding.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, right? I mean, compared to, you know, 40 other states, we're doing very, very well. And still, you know, we have a long, long way to go. And, you know, it's great to have a month that recognizes, you know, our accomplishments as well as, you know, all the things that we have left to do, you know, that recognizes that, you know, we've got a large percentage of people that have serious suicidal thoughts on, you know, a daily basis. Today alone, you know, there'll probably be more than 60 deaths in our country by suicide. And, you know, those statistics are daunting. They hit home, as we've seen, and we want to do all we can to spread the word so that, you know, we're working on it and getting the activism towards fighting the problem.
Dr. Newfield, how do you know if you are struggling with a mental health issue? Because I think if we're all being honest, we all have mental health checks. You know, like, I would be lying if I told you that there aren't days that I'm blue or down or off. I think everybody honestly has mental health crises or will have shifts in their mental health. But how do you know it's debilitating you?
You'll have problems performing the activities of daily life that help you help you live. You'll have difficulty getting out of bed and getting to work. You'll have, and I don't mean one day or 2 days, or, you know, if you don't like your job that you're avoiding work. But I mean, you've been doing these things consistently, and then there's a change in the pattern. You're not as hungry, and you're losing weight unexplainably. You're, you know, having problems sleeping. You're worrying, or you're more anxious. You're feeling down more consistently. It's not maybe 1 week, but it starts to stretch into multiple weeks and maybe months. And you know, we have this funny way of getting used to things. We're very adaptable, and you know, especially if we're busy, as many of us are. And well, I don't have the time to exercise, or I don't have the time to see a therapist, or I don't have the time to address these issues. It can really, you know, months can stretch into years very quickly, and before you know it, there's a problem. I think most important is listening to the people around you, and when they start to, you know, tell you that they're seeing differences or that they're starting to worry, taking it seriously and seeking out even your primary care provider and letting them know, you know, these are the struggles I've been having. What do you think is the best way to address this?
Well, Dr. Newfield, I really appreciate having you on the show, especially during May, Mental Health Awareness Month, and I know I'll have you back on very soon. Thank you for your time.
What kept flashing through my head was my baby. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is going to happen to me, because when it's on your pancreas, you know, like you're not going to be okay.
So you're hearing a very, very devastating interview that was done on the Today Show. Maria Menounos, who you probably know, a former E! News correspondent, revealed she is recovering from pancreatic cancer, and she learned about it right around the time that she and her husband had been expecting their first baby via a surrogate, and she was diagnosed. And in just a really traumatizing story for her to tell, obviously, but a lot of people reaching out and asking more about pancreatic cancer and just understanding it better. So having us back on the show, I should say, having back on the show, Dr. Charles Cha, who is with Hartford Healthcare. He is actually with the Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Cha is here to talk more about pancreatic cancer. Hi there, Dr. Cha. Thank you for your time. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about pancreatic cancer just in general. How common is it for people to be diagnosed with it?
Well, I think we should understand that it's a quite uncommon type of cancer to have. It's the 10th most common type of cancer to have, but it is the third or fourth deadliest type of cancer to have. And that's what's so insidious about it. It is something that, when it can be detected early, is quite curable, but if it's not detected early, it can be quite deadly.
What leads to pancreatic cancer, since it's not as common as some of the other cancers?
Well, most of the time, and when I see patients, they ask me this exact question. We don't know the exact cause. It just happens to certain people. There are certain things that do increase your risk, and these are related to smoking, unhealthy lifestyle, drinking, exposure to certain chemicals. But in general, there's some environmental factors, there's some genetic factors, but most patients, meaning 90%+ of patients we don't know, there's a small percentage of patients that have inherited genetic diseases that do increase your risk of cancer.
Now, I'm curious, in this regard to this story with Maria Menounos, how does pancreatic cancer impact having children?
Well, it depends on what stage you are and whether or not you need chemotherapy. But in general, most of our patients are in their 70s, so it's unusual to have a patient with pancreas cancer who is within childbearing age. But if it's early and it's surgically removable, it's something that can go hand in hand with a pregnancy.
And again, we're talking to Dr. Charles Cha about pancreatic cancer. This sounds like, in Maria's case, she had a health scare not that long ago. In 2017, she underwent surgery for a brain tumor. Now, is pancreatic cancer something that could be linked to other cancers, or is it something that typically comes on its own?
Well, depending on the type of cancer, sometimes it can be related to other types of cancer. But my understanding, she had a benign brain tumor. I don't believe that that was related. The type of cancer, and I'm not specifically familiar with her case, mm-hmm. but based on her description of it, it sounds like it's coming from the cells of the pancreas that produce endocrine factors, including insulin. And in that case, there are certain types of inherited diseases that can be associated with that type of cancer. But again, that's extremely rare and unusual. I think they're probably unrelated.
Now, what about the fact that she has type 1 diabetes? Is there any connection between diabetics and pancreatic cancer?
Yes, I think that that's a really important point. One of the things about pancreas cancer is it's quite insidious. It's very difficult to detect, and there's really no good screening for it. But one of the common, let's say, type of symptoms patients will have is new onset of diabetes. Abdominal pain, which I understand she had as well, unexplained weight loss are all things associated with pancreas cancer. Does that mean everybody with new onset diabetes has pancreas cancer? No, but if you have unexplained diabetes and unexplained weight loss and abdominal pain, it's something that probably should be investigated a little bit more.
So is this only something, Dr. Cha, you can check and confirm through like an MRI?
Yeah, unfortunately, like I said, there's no great screening study or test, whether that's blood test or simple type of imaging study to detect pancreas cancer. Really what you need is some type of CT scan or MRI to try to detect mass in the pancreas. And even a small mass in the pancreas, if it's smaller than, say, a couple centimeters in size, can be difficult to detect mm-hmm. even with those modalities. So it can be quite hidden. The pancreas is quite deep in the abdomen, so most patients don't have abdominal pain when they have pancreas cancer. And so you can have a relatively large pancreatic cancer that's growing within you without knowing that it's there.
So what does the treatment look like, Dr. Cha, if you are diagnosed with a pancreatic cancer? I mean, obviously the stages are going to look different, but what is the generic treatment the same as any other, like radiation?
So if you are eligible for surgery, surgery is the really only curative modality, but that's only if it can be caught early enough. Majority of patients with classic pancreatic cancer are not eligible for surgery because it's caught too late, because it has grown beyond the localized area. And in that setting, then the mainstay therapy would be chemotherapy, sometimes radiation, and sometimes we have a small percentage of patients that we can convert with chemotherapy and radiation to a situation where we can remove the tumor.
Can you live without your pancreas?
Absolutely. We used to think that without your pancreas that you would have uncontrolled diabetes and difficulty with digestion. But we do know now that with very careful glucose control, we have glucose pumps and monitors, that patients can live a very healthy and fruitful life without a pancreas. And so there are certain cases where we do need to take the entire pancreas out.
So my question with that, Dr. Cha, is if you're somebody who has a family history that includes pancreatic cancer, do you suggest at a younger age, when you're in a healthy and stable place, removing the pancreas?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think there's any data that has supported something that drastic, but there are certain patients who may have genetic disorders. You may have heard of BRCA1 and BRCA2 that's associated with breast cancer that can increase your risk for pancreas cancer. It's not quite as high as breast cancer, but those patients with those type of genetic disorders and family members with a history of specifically of pancreas cancer, we would do more intensive screening. Again, as I said, for the general population, there's not good screening, but those patients who are higher risk, we do MRIs and something called an endoscopic ultrasound, which is an ultrasound at the tip of an endoscope that can look through the wall of the stomach and visualize the pancreas. And we would do that yearly on those patients. But for the general population, unfortunately, there's no good screening study.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the works to find a good screening?
There's always things in the works. What is really been researched a lot is looking at stool, because a lot of the pancreatic cells are excreted into the stool.
Oh, interesting.
To see if you can detect pancreas cancer. There are serum studies. People are looking at circulating tumor DNA. But nothing has really been demonstrated so far to be an effective screening tool. But I have faith in our research community. I think something will be coming along down the pike in the next several years, but nothing as of yet.
Well, if anybody wants to learn more, you can always go to hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. And Dr. Charles Chaw, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, Dr. Chaw is the Hartford Healthcare Cancer, is with the Hartford Healthcare Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center here on WICC.